So as you can see, it's me, not Dad. And I'm back for at least a little bit. I gotta confess to you, I'm pretty excited to be here again. It's good to be standing before you again. It's been quite a while. And, you know, I've been kind of AWOL for the past couple of weeks. And, you know, I guess Dad's told me that a lot of you have expressed missing me. And I just want you to know that it's very returned. I've missed you guys a lot. It's hard to be away from church as long as I have been, even in just a couple weeks. And, you know, I've been in and out and in and out. And it's wearing after a while. Very wearing after a while. But y'all pray for me. I'm glad to be here. I'm a little rusty, but we'll see how this goes, and hopefully it's not too bad, and hopefully it's not, you know, over an hour. So we're looking at a very difficult book today, Ecclesiastes, right? I've mentioned this before. It's one of my favorite books. I love Ecclesiastes. I love it to death. And it's possibly my favorite Bible book. And I would say it's most definitely my favorite Old Testament book. But that said, it's a hard book to understand. It's a book of wisdom. And I think it's meant to be hard to understand. Acquiring wisdom takes effort. And it takes time. It's a hard book. And I want to confess something up front about this sermon today. I don't have everything figured out. The interpretations in this book are really hard to follow sometimes. And you'll find that if you listen to five different sermons on a chapter in Ecclesiastes, you will get five very different interpretations. It's quite maddening for the one that thinks that there's a right and wrong answer. But, you know, Dad says it's not a hard chapter, but he's a lot wiser than I am, so. But that said, please bear with me. I think there's a lot of good stuff in this book, a lot of good stuff in this chapter, and I think you're going to get a lot out of it. I certainly did. So, taking everything today, it's going to hurt a little bit, probably. It hurt me a little bit, but it was good. The pain's good. It's good. Because we grow. This is how we become wise, right? So, go ahead and turn over to Ecclesiastes chapter 10, please. Ecclesiastes chapter 10. And as you're turning there, I'm just going to talk for a little bit. We're going to talk through this. But it seems to me that the book of Ecclesiastes is divided into kind of sections, right? And I guess perhaps you can't really say, like, it's very clearly defined, like, here in chapter X it starts and here in chapter X it starts. But, you know, Solomon begins his kind of journey in kind of a depressing place, you know. He tells us that life under the sun is just sort of this vicious cycle. It's just this journey of meaningless pursuits, right? And it's depressing. And it's utterly unfulfilling. Utterly unfulfilling for the human being, right? And he tries to find purpose in life, and he basically says, you know, I tried everything, and there's nothing you could do to outdo me. I mean, I'm king. I've done everything. And, you know, I've done everything probably better than you could possibly do it, because, I'm king. I've tried everything there is to try, but I'm still so miserable. Why? And then, of course, he sort of finds hope in this seemingly unexpected place, right? He thinks of the simple and kind of maybe mundane act of eating and drinking. And he realizes, you know, well, there's nothing better than to do that, right? Just to find simple enjoyment out of that. And then he realizes, well, that's from God. So maybe some other stuff's from God, right? Maybe it's not just eating and drinking that's from God. Maybe everything else in life is from God, too. And that's kind of when he realizes that, yeah, all things are from God, ultimately. And then he spends the next chapters kind of investigating how this idea of life is in connection with God. And what he found out is that in order for life to have meaning, it must be lived within the context of living for God, right? That was kind of chapter 3 and so forth through there. you know, life living under the sun, so to speak, it's folly. It's purposeless. There's nothing there. Life is from God, must be to God, and if we ever want to have any hope in fulfilling the eternity that is embedded in our souls, then what? We must bow and begin at the very start of wisdom. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, right? The fear of the Lord. And so the preacher, in his olden age, he realizes what life is. He realizes what life is for and what meaning and purpose is. What we're here for and what we're here for is what God purposes, right? It's what we found out and what He found out. And everything, everyone, every matter under heaven has a season, a time appointed by God for His purposes, right? Remember that? And He's making everything beautiful in His own time. But then we're left with this sort of question, right? If we are to live for God, and if we're supposed to live life in connection and worship for Him, the question is, how do we do that? Well, Solomon, being the wise old man that he was, he gave us an answer, right? And sort of like a wise father or grandfather, you know, I mean, maybe you've had a figure like that in your life, or just sort of this person that's kind of wiser and they're able to give you advice. He sits us down and he gives us advice. Chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 9. It's all just practical wisdom, practical advice that he gives us. And he tells us how to obey God, right? And how to live a good life, a meaningful life. He tells us things that he's learned over the years. You know, he says things such as, hey, your exterior can be beautiful. You can acquire all the riches in the world, but if you're ugly on the inside, what do you have? What do you have? He says things like, it's better to mourn. It's better to mourn and weep, because that's when you actually reflect on life, right? When you go to the house of mourning, that's when you start to evaluate yourself and where you are with God. Nobody does that when they're laughing and having a good time. Not that those things are bad, but it's better to be in the house of mourning. He says things like, obey authorities, right? Seems kind of simple, but obey authorities. For God's sake, obey authorities. He says, vote Republican in 20... No, I'm just kidding. But what he ultimately finds in this life is that two things at the end of the day matter. Wisdom and folly. Living your life wisely or living it foolishly. And it comes down to wisdom that saves you and tends to enhance your life, or folly that damns you and makes life unbearable. That's what it comes down to at the end of, the day. He says, don't get caught up in the popularity stuff. No, that it's all temporary. Don't get caught up in that stuff. It comes down to, are you living wisely or are you living foolishly? That's what it comes down to at the end of the day. So, I suppose, you know, as we come to chapter 10 sort of marks, I guess, what I would call almost this concluding section, right? And He's kind of nearing the end of his investigation, right? He's getting kind of close to the end here. He's told us the meaning of life. He's told us how to live wisely before God. He's told us how to do this. And now he's going to look at wisdom and he's going to look at folly conceptually. He's going to look at it. And what he's basically going to tell us is that, you know, if you haven't been convinced that living wisely before God is what you should be doing, then this chapter right here is the argument for why wisdom is better. I've entitled this kind of in my notes, Wisdom versus Folly. That's what this chapter is. It is the battle between wisdom and folly. That's what it is. That's what this is. He's going to go through and he's going to show us that wisdom indeed is superior in all forms and how detrimental folly can be. And he's just going to explore the characteristics of it. So, real quick, you know, what is the fool? What is folly? What is that stuff? It's not necessarily being or not being able to pass something like an academic test. That's not really what fool and folly is talking about. Foolishness and folly, they're the ones that have said in their heart, there is no God, right? That's the biblical definition of a fool, right? One who despises instruction and wisdom and knowledge. The person who is living life under the sun. that is a fool, right? That is a fool. And as you read, challenge yourself. Ask yourself, am I living as a fool or am I living wisely? This chapter is sort of a mirror for ourselves. Evaluate yourself as you're going through. And this is why this chapter can be kind of painful to read. Because yes, even Christians can lapse into foolish living. I mean, yes, there are the ones who have said there is no God. But sometimes, don't we sometimes act like a fool? Do we not? So as we're going through, check yourself. Because it's convicting. Just check yourself. So we're going to get through this. Take it in. The hurt is good. It's good. This is how we grow. We acquire wisdom by evaluating ourselves against Scripture. So, let's go ahead and read verse 1 in chapter 10. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. Now this verse is better understood on the heels of what Solomon said in chapter 9. Okay, so if you want to actually back up just a little bit, let's read from verse 13 down to verse 1 of 10, following. This wisdom have I seen also under the sun, and it seemed great unto me. There was a little city, and few men within it, and there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in it a poor wise man, and he by his wisdom delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. Then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. The words of wise men are heard in quiet more than the cry of him that ruleth among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is in reputation for wisdom and honor. You see how that fits a little bit better? Wisdom is mightier than physical strength, right? It's mightier than that. It's better than a weapon. It's the best defense that a person has. Read the earlier chapters if you want to see that. But you'll notice that, as Solomon says in verse 18 of chapter 9, wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroyeth much good. That idea is what we're looking for here. In ancient times, making perfumes and fragrances, it was a complicated process. They didn't have factories and things that made ointments and things like that and kind of perfumes. It was expensive and it was a sensitive process. And from what I understand, when you were kind of mixing everything together, if one little insect would fly into the batch and die, the whole batch was ruined. Everything was just destroyed. That's what we're kind of looking at. The whole concoction was just spoiled. So in other words, this is the modern day translation of this. One bad apple spoils the whole bunch. That's what he's saying. One bad apple spoils the whole bunch. And so what he's telling us here is that while wisdom is magnificent and it should be strove for, one act of folly, one bit of foolishness is enough to cause catastrophe. That's what he's talking about here. Look at how destructive folly is. Look at how awful it is. It tears apart goodliness and wisdom. And we're all prone to this, both Christians and the lost. I mean, case in point, there was a wise man after God's own heart, right? He was beloved by his nation and everyone else. And you know who I'm talking about. King David, right? Right? And the Psalms are filled with his wisdom and his knowledge of God and all this stuff. But we all remember that one time, right? What was her name? Bathsheba? We all remember that? One act of foolishness. One act of folly destroys so much sometimes. And you might say, okay, well, that was pretty extreme. I mean, that was adultery and that was murder, right? Well, what about when someone just snaps and maybe punches someone? What about when somebody explodes angrily or something like that? What about just the little things, just one little instance that can ruin so much, right? It's one little rotten apple of folly, of just unbridled and foolish living, it's enough to tarnish wisdom. Years of living wisdom, right? And we have to be vigilant against this foolishness. This is sort of the first thing that Solomon lays out for us. He's like, okay, so again, if you're not convinced yet that you should be living wisely, look at how destructive foolishness is. Look at how destructive folly is. So we need to be vigilant against it, right? So then, he goes on to say something else. Look at what he says in verse 2 and 3. A wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. Now, those of you that are left-handed, if any, need not be alarmed. I mean, you're weird, don't get me wrong. But this verse isn't talking about being left or right-handed necessarily. It's not. It goes a lot deeper than that. And Solomon has just showed us how destructive foolishness is, right? He's shown us how destructive folly is. Now, the question then is, where does this come from? Where does folly come from? Where does wisdom come from? Where does it come from? And what's the mechanism? Well, speaking in general terms here, I mean, again, you might be the one out of 70 that use your left hand for whatever reason. But what he's saying here is that generally the right hand is the dominant hand, right? Most things are made for right-handed people. Most people are dominant with their right hand. The right hand is typically more adept. That's what he's getting at here. This is symbolism, right? And the NASB actually kind of, I think, translates this a little bit more clearly. It says that a wise man's heart leads him to the right, and the foolish man's heart leads him to the left. Right? So, the right and left here are symbols for what is good and what is bad. That's what it's talking about. But look at what verse 2 says about the mechanism. Look here. Oh, I got to turn back over. So it says, a wise man's heart is at his right hand. Or is it at his right hand, I'm sorry. But a fool's heart is at his left. A fool's heart. So, the mechanism, what is it? It comes from the heart, right? Wisdom and foolishness, this is where it comes from. And once again, let me reiterate, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God, right? This is not an external issue. It's an entirely internal issue that's going on here. It's an internal battle and struggle. And the heart must be set upon the wise things of life, the good things, to guard against folly. Otherwise, you have verse 3, right? Got to turn back over. Verse 3. Yea, also, when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. It's manifest to all that can see, right? Listen, I mean, you know when you meet a fool, right? And Solomon isn't being so literal here that, you know, just every fool can't find their way on the road or something. I mean, that's me. I can't follow directions. But, I mean, what he simply means here is that even in the mundane and ordinary course of life, it tends to manifest, right? I mean, you know when somebody's a fool. They show it. And wisdom also manifests itself in life. Don't forget. I mean, it definitely does, but unfortunately, I would say that folly and foolishness tends to manifest a little more clearly than wisdom. And once again, you know, one drop of folly is enough to ruin years of good wise living. Right? But nonetheless, both are made apparent in some form or fashion, I think. And I'm going to say I think a lot today because I don't have everything down 100%, and I'm trying. But I think verse 4 here is an example of how it manifests, okay? Let's read verse 4 really quick. Let me show you what I mean. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. Now, the word spirit here is better translated anger or temperament, something like that. And basically, this is the ancient Near Eastern version of, I can't take my boss anymore, I'm sick of this, and I'm done. That's what it is. And the word ruler here simply denotes one that has an officer position above you. It's not necessarily talking about the king. It's just talking about basically what? The boss. That's what it's talking about, the boss. So, the boss does something mean, ticks you off, and you have a choice here. You can explode and triumphantly charge out, abandoning your post, or you can respond calmly and defuse the situation. Which one seems wise to you? I mean, the boss is watching you, your coworkers are watching you, and you want to know how a fool manifests themselves? They let emotions get the best of them. They just explode. That's what a fool does. And, you know, the boss is likely being a fool already, probably. I mean, the boss is always wrong, right? So they're probably being a fool. But two wrongs definitely don't make a right, even if he is being a fool or she. But the wise person, while not necessarily being a doormat, it's not saying be a doormat, but what it is saying here is that the wise person, so to speak, responds by diffusing the situation and reconciling what is going on. They pacify it, right? We strive for peace, and this could happen any day. And it's probably happened to you at some point. It's happened to me, and I haven't been alive that long, so I'm sure it's happened to you guys. So, he's not saying, you know, never leave your job or something. It's the broader picture. And he's going to use a lot of these sort of illustrations and symbols to kind of look at broader contexts. So think broad as we're reading through this, but, you know, the wise person responds to offensive and angry outbursts by diffusing it, right? And people who are watching see that person must be wise, right? The fool just pours gasoline over the entire thing and makes it explode even more. They haven't tamed their heart down like a wise person has. So, wisdom is better than folly. That's what we've seen so far. Yet, it's oftentimes folly that is sought after, which destroys much good and wisdom. And the heart is the source of the two, and it manifests very clearly in life situations, right? That's what we've seen so far. But the exposition continues. He's not done yet. There's a lot more to this. You know, we know that, okay, so it manifests clearly, we know where it comes from, and we know that wisdom, according to Solomon, is better than folly, but is he done? No. He's going to construct his argument a little bit more, and he's going to explore this a little bit more. Despite folly being extremely destructive and obvious to everyone that sees it, it's not always punished. In fact, well, let's go ahead and read here. Verses 5 through 7. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun, as an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity, and the rich set in low place. I have seen servants upon horses, and princes walking as servants among the earth. All right. As far as I can tell, this is one giant analogy. I mean, maybe he's being literal here with the horses and the princes and everything, but with some research and a gut feel, I just don't think he's talking about actual horses and actual princes here. I think it's metaphorical in nature. From the top all the way to the bottom at times, folly in this broken world is exalted. Is it not? Wisdom is kicked to the curb, typically. And I think that the rich here, when it says folly is set in great dignity and the rich sit in low place, I think the rich can be taken to mean rich in wisdom. Because the contrast before is talking about fools or folly. So, you know, turn on the television for a couple minutes. I mean, watch the news. Look at the things that are going on around us. Godless, unholy, and ignorant things are exalted around us every single day. You know, as you all probably know, I'm part of the speech and debate team at my university. And these people, I halfway live with them. I kind of have to love them. I have to get along with them. But for whatever reason, across the board, across universities in the speech community, they just tend to be secular, godless, and foolish. And I don't think there's a better way to put it, really. I know that's not very gentle, but God is slandered, and it's applauded in the speech community, the debate community. They're so knowledgeable about so many things, but they lack wisdom. They lack wisdom. And it's celebrated. Wisdom is not accepted there. It's hated. It's despised. And it's not just that faucet of wisdom and folly. It's not just in academia. I mean, look at entertainment. Look at anything in our culture. People tend to exalt folly. People tend to exalt fools to the top. And they dismiss wisdom. and it's part of the curse. It's part of our nature. I mean, see, here's the thing, and lest any of us forget, we all start as fools. We are all naturally fools, right? It shouldn't surprise us that these things are exalted. No, I mean, the only reason we have wisdom at all is because God has granted us such, right? The only reason we have any good, true wisdom. In our natural state, everybody is a fool. So, wisdom, sadly, though, so far has been shown to procure better outcomes, right? It's, I mean, even though it does that, it's pushed to the better, it's pushed to the other side, typically. And not only does folly destroy wisdom, but oftentimes it makes it to where people don't even care about wisdom, which is, in some cases, worse, I think, because people don't even know that it's there, and they don't care. It's apathetic. It's apathetic. Apathy. So, that's sad, but Solomon's going to show us a little bit more here about wisdom. And that said, just because folly tends to overpower wisdom sometimes doesn't mean that folly is better. It's a sad state, and he's going to show us why it's sad. He's not saying that it's good that folly overpowers wisdom. It's actually a tragedy. And he's going to show us why here. Look at verses 8 to 11. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it, and whoso breaketh an hedge, a serpent shall bite him. A hedge is a wall. Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. If the iron be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, then must he put to more strength, but wisdom is profitable to direct. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. Now, there are a few interpretations of this block of text, and I understand why. Solomon is using ancient pictures for us here, and admittedly, yeah, that's a little hard to interpret when you're looking at it a good few thousand years in the future. But here's what I think best fits contextually, okay? This is a series of many illustrations, like tiny illustrations, many. Four professions are presented to us, yeah? There's a pit digger, a wall breaker, a stone quarrier, and a lumberjack, basically. That's what's presented here. And they're going about their business as they have, probably for years. They go to work, they work. And then all of a sudden, bam, something bad happens, right? He falls into the pit. Whoa, snake bites a dude. Some rocks fell, accidentally just slipped and fell. Or the piece of wood splits and it cuts the person. Accidents, chance, whatever you want to call it. It just happened. And there were risks, they knew that, but it hadn't happened. I mean, they couldn't control the risks or anything. They've been doing this for years. And then it just sort of happened, right? Now, if we stopped here, that would be strange and inconclusive of Solomon. That would be sort of odd why he would do that. But these verses come on the heels of what we just read, and also we have verses that come after it, right? We have verses 10 and 11, not just 8 and 9. We have 10 and 11. And I actually want to read verses 11 and 12, I'm sorry, verses 10 and 11 with the NASB real quick. Just listen. If the axe is dull and he does not sharpen its edge, then he must exert more strength. Wisdom has the advantage of giving success. If the serpent bites before being charmed, there is no profit for the charmer. All right, follow me here. Solomon is saying that wisdom is better than folly because even though people exalt folly over wisdom daily, even though it destroys wisdom so much sometimes, and even though we can't control life circumstances half the time, and sometimes things just happen, it still pays to be wise, does it not? It really does. Verses 10 and 11 are literally basically the old way of saying, my Granny Carol is going to be so proud if she listens to this, think smarter, not harder. That's what it's saying. I mean, that's the surface level meaning here. An axeman who cuts at a tree with a dull axe for hours, that's stupid. That's stupid, is it not? I mean, sharpen the axe. If you're a snake charmer, don't sit there 10 inches from a cobra and just wait for it to bite you. That's stupid. I'm not sure why you would want to charm a snake anyway, but at least charm it if you're going to do it. Be wise. That's kind of the surface-level meaning, but I also think contextually the meaning can be stretched further than just think smarter, not harder. Despite life often being tumultuous and unpredictable in this sin-cursed and broken world that exalts folly, it pays to be wise. You navigate this world effectively by being wise. And generally, not always, not immediately, but generally, wisdom produces a better outcome. Right? If not now in this life, surely in the next life. Surely. But yeah, folly in this life tends to just make this already hard life harder. That's what he's saying. It's wearisome. Imagine the fatigue of a man who is just cutting and cutting and cutting with a dull... I assume that gets pretty tiring after a while. But that's what life is like for the fool. They're just cutting and cutting and cutting. It's wearisome. It's wearisome. It's madness. It's what it is, madness. And you can see this more down in verse 15. You'll see that in a little bit. It's kind of the state that a fool ends up in. But the fool cannot rely on God, even. He hates knowledge and instruction. He can't control himself. No wonder the snake bit the charmer. What an easy target. But Solomon's still not finished, though. He's managed to set up this foundation for wisdom producing better outcomes, and this is true in several instances. It's not just in chance happenings or whatever. Look at what he says about speech itself in the next few verses. Verses 12 to 14, he says, "The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be and what shall be after him. Who can tell him?" You ever met someone that just wouldn't shut up? Bethany and Trey are currently thinking, yeah, you, Austin. But, if you read back in chapter 3, you'll notice that there's a time to speak and there's a time to be silent. What does Proverbs have to say on this matter? Proverbs 17, 27, 28, you don't have to turn there. "He who restrains his words has knowledge, and he who has a cool spirit is a man of understanding. Even a fool, when he keeps silent, is considered wise. When he closes his lips, he is considered prudent." A person's speech reveals where they are, right? And there's even more scripture to back this up with. If you don't believe me, take it from Jesus, Matthew 12, 34. "You brood of vipers, how can you speak good when you are evil? For out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks." Right? This was from Jesus himself, if you couldn't tell again. But do you remember where folly and wisdom come from? They come from the heart, remember? Right? And when the wise man speaks, the heart that has been directed to the right, the good path, the words that come out are gracious. Because the heart is in the right place, so the mouth speaks the good things, the gracious things. The words are Christ-like. They are wise. But when the heart has turned, when the person is foolish, they speak and what comes out? Trash. That's what comes out. Trash, and it doesn't stop. It just keeps pouring out. The tongue is full of poison. And the fool just spits it out until they are consumed and eaten by it. The Hebrew here, where it says, "The lips of a fool will swallow up himself," it's speaking about self-destruction. Just self-implosion, destruction, whatever the word you want to use. Practically, in application, I suppose, in surface level, I say this to myself and all of us, if we want to be wise, let's watch our mouths. I guess that's kind of the surface level thing going on here. The language we use is a giant indicator of where we are spiritually and morally, whether we are wise or foolish, is it not? And I hope you can see how this is laid out, but I also hope you can see how Solomon is laying this sort of argument out here of why we should guard our mouths in the first place. Wisdom is obviously better than folly. Wisdom is better than foolishness here. And that's why we should guard our mouths. It produces a far better outcome, right? gracious words of truth and purpose are much more productive than words of self-destruction, are they not? Right? The fool continues on and on and on, helping no one, not even himself. He just continues on. And even in something as simplistic and basic to the human being as talking, wisdom is better. It outweighs folly every time. Every single time. Now, we're getting kind of close here to the end of our text, but Solomon has told us a lot about wisdom and foolishness so far, how destructive folly is, where the source of wisdom and folly is, how the two manifest very clearly, and how the world exalts folly over wisdom, and how wisdom is still better and it pays to be wise despite the exaltation of folly in this world. He's told us about that, and he's even said this is apparent in the most basic thing to human beings, talking, language, right? And so we have all this knowledge now. We know that wisdom is better than folly. And we're able to approach verse 15. If everything Solomon has said about wisdom and folly is true this far, then we have verse 15. Where's the fool left at the end of the day? Verse 15. The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. The word "because" isn't great here. Here's the ESV version. The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Finding the city was integral to life back then. It was simple. Everyone could do it. I mean, even stupid people knew how to find the city. That's how you went to go commerce with people. That's how you went to trade. That you went to the city, right? The city was kind of the hub. People knew where the city was. It was basic. But Solomon posits this sort of extreme example here. And he basically says that the toil of a fool is so wearisome for him that he can't even make his way to the city. He's basically blind. That's what he's saying here. And many of you know that I don't really like to make conjectures about Scripture, and I'm not a fan of expanding beyond what I think is allowed here in the text, so I'm going to try not to do that here, but here's what I think the broader context of this text is. I think that foolishness and folly is so clouding, so destructive, and so harmful to a person that the fool is left to utter despair in trying to navigate their own life. That's how bad it is. Life, you know, the cycle, right? That thing that Solomon talked about for like the last 9 chapters, life, the cycle. The fool cannot even find his way to the city, right? So how could they possibly navigate life? How could they find meaning? How could they find God if they can't find their way to the city? Meaning, purpose, anything, they can't find it. The most basics of basics for the ancient people. So they're left wandering, and they're left grasping, searching but never finding. Tell me that folly is better than wisdom. Tell me that groping aimlessly and not knowing how to navigate life is better. It isn't. Wisdom wins every single time. Every time. The life of a fool is wearisome, it's painful, and it's meaningless. It's life under the sun is what it is, without God. Look at how Solomon portrays this kind of person, and he uses another illustration. Verses 16 through 19 read, "Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child and thy princes eat in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of nobles and thy princes eat in due season for strength and not for drunkenness." That's the wise person. But back to the foolish person. "By much slothfulness the building decayeth, and through idleness of the hands the house droppeth through. A feast is made for laughter, and wine maketh merry, but money answereth all things." The fool here, the child, they don't know what they're doing. They're clueless. They're not wise. They're idle. Now, verse 17 is talking about a wise person in contrast, but 16, 18, and 19, that's the foolish person. They're making horrible decisions. They're basically throwing parties at an unrelentless pace, and the house itself begins to just collapse. Actually, the probably better literal translation here is the roof is literally sinking in. That's what's happening. They're so, oblivious, They're so oblivious to what's going on that the house itself is beginning to cave in. That's what's happening here. And they look around and they're like, eh, money will fix it. Money answers everything. That's how Solomon's portraying the fool here. While everything around him is falling apart. That's how Solomon portrays them. But should we be surprised at this? That they don't care? That they're not caring? That they're brash and it's causing destruction? That they hardly even notice? We shouldn't be surprised. No, they can't even find their way to the city, right? They're so blind that they can't find the way to the city. The fool is shrouded in darkness. And he's being sarcastic in verse 19, if you didn't catch what I said there. Money certainly is versatile. It does answer a lot of things in life. I'm not going to deny that. But I think he's being sarcastic in saying that the fool simply just doesn't care, and he brushes it off by saying, yeah, money will fix it. Yeah, it's okay. That's what I think he's saying. It's folly, and it's destructive, and it doesn't end well. So then we have this last verse, verse 20. And I think, without going through the whole chapter summary again, I think you can see wisdom is better than folly. I think you can see that's what Solomon's trying to tell us today. Every time. Every situation. Knowledge and discerning application, that's wisdom, is always the right way to go. Always. And because of that, Solomon gives us a good admonishment here to end the chapter. And he says, curse not the king, no, not in thy thought, and curse not the rich in thy bedchamber, for a bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. Now, surface level practical application. Don't gossip and slander. It'll get back to you. That's the basic meaning. And it's a very revealing thing for foolishness, as we saw, but what's the broader context here? Remember, broader context. These are all pictures and analogies. What is the context? Even in your very own thoughts, even in the privacy of your bedroom, don't be a fool. Don't be a fool. Don't choose folly, because your heart and mind should be geared towards wisdom to begin with, right? Wisdom that is calm and good. Sanctifying wisdom. That's where we should be. So even in our private quarters, even in the crevices of our own minds, we shouldn't be fools. We shouldn't be thinking bad things, because already we've already started to go the wrong way with our heart. We should be going towards the right way with wisdom. And you know, that is sanctifying wisdom, isn't it? That constant battle. For those that are saved here, gaining this wisdom is a process that we call sanctification. That's what we call it. Sanctifying process, sanctification. It's a hard process, but it's a good one, isn't it? It's a hard battle, but it's good, and it's one that we should all fight. It's one that we should be striving for. And this book has great sanctifying wisdom in it. Proverbs, even more so. Looking to the life of Christ is, I mean, we say that Solomon was the wisest person that ever lived. That's actually not true. Christ was the wisest person that ever lived. Solomon's probably like number two or something. But we gain wisdom from these things. We should all work very hard to obtain the kind of wisdom that manifests even when we're alone. That is true wisdom. When we are wise, even when nobody except for God is watching, right? That is wisdom. That is wisdom. And I think Solomon makes a compelling argument for living wisely in this chapter. I mean, he's seen this played out. And might I remind you that Solomon lived the life of a fool. He knows how destructive it is. He lived it. He did it. He did everything. Remember, he was the king that went astray. He did it. He knows. And I think it would do us all well, it would do me well, I know that, to evaluate myself. And remind myself that I should be living wiser. Even in my own thoughts, even in the crevices of privacy, I should be living wisely, right? That's what we're called to do. So let's do that together, right? We should do that together. But, another word, I would assert that maybe this book, although, yes, very good for the Christian, very good for the saved, and very good for those that are not living life under the sun, so to speak, I would say that this book is just as equally, if not more, for the one that is living under the sun, that doesn't know God, that is living life, yes, like a fool. Like a fool. Completely. Not even just a little bit. completely. Solomon has explained how wisdom is better, but how would one become wise in the first place? How would one even come to live life for God? Well, the beginning of all knowledge is the fear of the Lord. That's the beginning of it. So what does that mean? It means be afraid. That's what it means. Be afraid. Respect Him and bow to Him. The fool toils wearily through life because there is no purpose aside from the Lord. Right? There is no purpose aside from God. So the fool who does not believe, the fool that doesn't know God, they toil all day, every day. There was a person I met yesterday, just briefly. I was talking to them and we were talking, and I said something to the effect of, what do you care about most in life? And they said, making it to the next day. And I said, well, why is that? And they said, well, it's the same old crap every day. It's just another day, right? That's the fool. That's the fool. Without God. Until you bow and ask for forgiveness, believing in His Son as Savior, whom He has sent to provide reconciliation between God and man, you're walking in utter folly, which never wins ultimately, right? Wisdom is better than folly every single time. It may be exalted for now. It may seem like it is. It may seem like it's overpowering wisdom. But ultimately, truly, the only thing that it is damning. That's the only thing that folly is. The only thing that unbelief is. You want to be wise? The first thing you do is you ask for forgiveness for being foolish and sinful. And again, as Christians, quick side note, we should probably ask for forgiveness often for that too, being foolish and acting foolish. But again, back to what I was saying, once you've believed in the name of Christ, the Lord will teach you wisdom, right? And don't take my word for it, don't take Dad's word for it. Take the King Solomon's words, right? Take his word for it. He tried everything. And the only thing that broke the cycle of meaningless, the only thing that fulfilled him and stopped his foolishness, the only thing that saved him at the end of the day was the wisdom given from Creator God above. We'll end there.